You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jonathan Alter is a senior editor and award-winning columnist at Newsweek magazine, which is a great perch for witnessing and writing about many of the biggest news events of the past 20 years or so. He's put together a collection of his Newsweek pieces in a book named after his columns, Between the Lines, A View Inside American Politics, People, and Culture. It's published by Borders Books under the State Street Press imprint, and I'm pleased that it brings Jonathan Alter to the show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
And I should mention there are actually two books that people are talking about, because an earlier one called The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, has made the newspapers.
Well, yes, I'm pleased to have learned that. On Sunday night, Barack Obama was on 60 Minutes, and he mentioned that he was reading a book about Franklin Roosevelt's first 100 days. And the next day I was called by the New York Times and asked, well, was that your book? Because I'd written this book on that, and he'd used the phrase a defining moment, both in his victory speech in Chicago and on other occasions. And my answer was, I don't know. But by the end of the day, they had learned from the Obama camp transition team that indeed the president-elect was referring to the defining moment, and also to a book by Jean Edward Smith called FDR. So he mentioned two books. And it's nice to know that we are going to have a president who can read more than one book at the same time.
And also perhaps try to learn something about what happened in the past. Although, is it applicable? Is the first 100 days of the Roosevelt administration in any way applicable to this? Can get much done today in the first 100 days?
I do think it's applicable. Obama doesn't want to be limited to 100 days, and actually John F. Kennedy was also very concerned about this, and so he talked about how they wouldn't even accomplish everything in 1,000 days. Then that became the name of Arthur Schlesinger's book, or even in our lifetime, JFK said in his inaugural. And indeed, he didn't get much done in his first 100 days. But both Lyndon Johnson in 1965 and Ronald Reagan in 1981 got a lot accomplished in their first 100 days, and I think the expectations are quite high that Obama do the same.
Because people are rooting for him to get something done. That's part of it. If you're not going to face a lot of resistance, you actually can accomplish something.
Right, and also it helps, as Rahm Emanuel has said, to have a crisis, and it helped greatly not just Franklin Roosevelt, but also Ronald Reagan. But the Roosevelt comparison is almost eerily apt, and it applies in the transition as well, where right now Obama is trying to figure out how much does he get involved in the economic crisis, and Roosevelt faced that same question.
And this is being compared to the point where one of the magazines, yours, I think, had a cover of Barack Obama with an FDR cigarette holder.
It was actually what we call Brand X, Time magazine that did that. But I'm now working on a piece about Roosevelt and his transition. And there were a number of things. Just to give you one thing that's come to mind that relates to something that he could do in the early days of his administration that would be kind of reminiscent of something that Roosevelt did. Roosevelt didn't just get 15 different pieces of legislation through Congress in 1933. He also did other lesser-known things. And one that came to mind for me recently was that there was terrible hoarding going on. You remember the banks were all closed, and they had a banking crisis that was actually quite similar to a part of what we're going through now, a credit crisis. And he said that he would publish the names of all of those wealthy individuals who took money out of the banks and didn't return it, who hoarded their gold and other currency. And all he had to do was threaten to do that. And, of course, they went scurrying back to the banks. And so it occurred to me that maybe Barack Obama could say, since they didn't put it in the bailout bill, that he could say that they will publish the names of those executives receiving bailout money who take million-dollar bonuses, which they clearly don't deserve. And I think that would have a pretty good effect on their willingness to take those bonuses.
Now, the defining moment was your opportunity to write about history of the past, but these columns that you've included in Between the Lines with commentary, talking about how things have worked out in some cases since, are really writing history on the fly. And sometimes you even get things wrong, or
yes,
you admit to having gotten things wrong.
I tried to admit to such, yeah.
You've organized them by topic rather than chronologically. Why that approach?
You know, I thought it made sense to have them at least thematically related. So I have a section on the Bushes and a section on the Clintons, a section on columns that I wrote about history.
So we really see history unfold in an odd way as new things alter, forgive me for the pun on your name, alter your way of seeing things.
Yeah, I thought it would be I just thought it would be more interesting and sort of hang together better if I grouped those columns. And then I also grouped the ones that I did that were about me personally. And so I thought that the subject matter worked better than just a straight chronology would be, since the particular dates are not as important, although I include them in there to give people the chronology.
My guest is Jonathan Alter, whose latest book is Between the Lines, A View Inside American Politics, People, and Culture, a Borders Books exclusive, with a foreword by John Meacham. And you must have looked back at some of those things and said, boy, was I wrong about that. For example, the column you wrote about Rudolph Giuliani after 9/11.
Yeah. Well, you know, I didn't think that the column, that particular column, doesn't hold up horribly because he did do some great things after 9/11. But I felt strongly, very, very strongly, and tried to make amends in 2007, I felt strongly that he absolutely should under no circumstances be president of the United States. And so I tried to do some penance for those rather slobbering columns that I did about him right after 9/11. But I'd done the first interview with him about where he was on 9/11. And then I went with him and President Bush on 9/14. To Ground Zero, where Bush famously used the bullhorn. So I was there for a lot of that, and I wrote other columns that I've included in that collection about just what it was like in New York in that period and wandering around lower Manhattan.
And it is different when you're an eyewitness to the real event, isn't it, when you're standing there, although it can color it in another way.
Yeah, I wasn't there on 9/11 itself, and there are plenty of people.
No,
in New
we
York
were.
Who were. You were. Yeah.
We were just a few blocks away in the municipal building, and actually, the dust came down as far as the municipal building from the World Trade Center site.
Yeah. So you were much more eyewitnesses to history than I was. But I went down, you know, starting the next day and the days
well,
after.
Well, being
that,
there when Giuliani and Bush. Yeah. Did their famous things. Well, that was
right.
Really an eyewitness to history.
I was standing about 5 feet away from this collapsed fire truck, and I saw a guy who looked like he was out of Central Casting, an older fireman with a wonderful fire hat on, and I motioned to our photographer, who was also in the pool, what we call the press pool, small group of reporters who were allowed to go down there, and I said, get a picture of him. And right as I said that, somebody from the White House came over to him and said, the president is going to come up here and stand with you and put and indeed Bush hops up like 5 feet from me and puts his arm around him and then uses the bullhorn. And I said to Ari Fleischer afterward, who was at the time Bush's press secretary, I said, I was already writing my book, by the way. I said, this is a defining moment for your boss's presidency. And he later put in his book that he hadn't quite realized that he was seeing history being made until I had come up to him and said, we just saw history. This will be in the, you know, in the permanent record of George Bush's presidency.
Do you think that affected you in the, to the point where you supported the Iraq War initially? Or was that something different?
I think it was a combination of, feeling 9/11 personally like you and so many other New Yorkers, knowing people who had died on 9/11, But I wasn't assuming a connection the way the Bush people, in an obscene way, tried to, make a connection between 9/11 and Iraq. I think for me, it was really more about weapons of mass destruction, and that I had been convinced through my reporting that they did have weapons of mass destruction, and that it was only a question of whether we take them out sooner or later in order to protect ourselves. And when, I found, along with the rest of the world, that we had been misled or lied to, and that they didn't have weapons of mass destruction, I felt pretty much the way the rest of the world did. But I think that there were, if you think back, I gave Barack Obama a lot of credit for understanding in advance, and I give everybody credit who understood in advance, including my own father, who fought and saw a lot of action in World War II. He knew it was a dumb war, the way Obama did. But there were a lot of other people, including Hillary Clinton and plenty of others, who felt the same way, that if there were weapons of mass destruction, that we needed to do something about it. So sometimes we're wrong, and what I objected to in the campaign was when the Clintons tried to make it seem like Obama had not been right and that they had had the same position at the time, which was simply untrue. Obama was much more farsighted on it than I was or Hillary Clinton.
Often politicians pay the price for being farsighted on wars. We've seen any number of people being voted out of office. For example, Wayne Morse.
Right.
When he was one of the only people, maybe the only senator.
He and Ernest Gruning from Alaska, they were the only two.
That was a different Alaska.
Yes, that was the Mike Gravel Alaska. Yeah, Wayne Morse was a wonderful senator from Oregon who changed parties a couple of times and was really a man of principle.
Do you worry that you're an opinion maker and might have influenced readers in favor of something that you later felt was wrong?
Yes, and particularly with one column, which I included in there to show my own folly. I wrote a column in late 2001 when I was still so traumatized by 9/11 and by the fact that we hadn't caught the perpetrators of the greatest crime in American history. And I endorsed not physical torture, but psychological torture, playing loud music and this kind of thing. I gave credence to Alan Dershowitz's ideas on this. And I regretted it pretty quickly afterward because people were not able to draw a distinction between psychological and physical, and it looked like I was endorsing torture, which I didn't want to do and didn't intend to do. And I included it in the collection just to show that pundits make plenty of mistakes.
Well, this goes with the territory of being a pundit. I've noticed in some cases TV pundits make mistake after mistake after mistake, and they always wind up getting better and better jobs.
That's true. That's particularly true with predictions. People never seem to hold pundits accountable for their predictions. I try not to make political predictions because we're so often wrong. I mean, we're definitely wrong more than right on that. And I think that non-journalists can predict just as easily as journalists. And it's like asking people to predict where the stock market's going to go. And yet, over and over again, we're asked what's going to happen in the New York primary. So I think it's a kind of a silly form of journalism, and I have to do it sometimes, but try to avoid it as much as I can.
And nobody has been punished for predicting that the market was going to do great.
Right.
Get into the market, buy a house. Jonathan Alter is a senior editor at Newsweek, where for two decades he's written a column on politics, media, and culture that's won more than a dozen major journalism awards. He's also a contributing correspondent and analyst for NBC News and appears regularly on Countdown with Keith Olbermann and other MSNBC programs. He is a 2006 national bestseller, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days, and The Triumph of Hope. Not only will be an HBO movie, but right now we understand is being read for all the information that can be gleaned from it by Barack Obama. His latest book is a collection of his columns, some of the columns, called Between the Lines, A View Inside American Politics, People, and Culture, published by State Street Press, which is an imprint of Borders. We will continue our conversation after this. Mm-hmm. We're back with Jonathan Alter, whose latest book is a collection of his columns, his Between the Lines columns, called Between the Lines, A View Inside American Politics, People and Culture. It's published by State Street Press. You also were the one of the creators or the creator of the Conventional Wisdom section.
Yes.
In Newsweek.
Back in 1988, 20 years ago, Mickey Kouse, who was one of the very first political bloggers, Kouse Files on Slate.com, some of you may be familiar with, he was at that time working at Newsweek, and the two of us got very tired of putting conventional thinking, conventional wisdom in our political stories about the 1988 campaign, and we eventually convinced editors to let us do it just in a box with the silliest, most ridiculous conventional wisdom of the week. And we've been, Mickey has long since left, but I've been doing it with others at Newsweek for the last 20 years.
But what it also shows is that conventional wisdom keeps on changing. So should we even respect it? Should we pay much attention
no,
to it?
No, you should not respect it. I mean,
I remember when people were predicting, well, now because of the blue dress, Bill Clinton will not be able to stay in office for more than 3 weeks.
Well, we do this thing frequently where we say old CW, new CW, and it's often 180 degrees opposite. People absolutely should not respect it. The reason that we do it, aside from just lampooning the news, is to develop a consciousness of it, almost a reader literacy, so that people understand that hackneyed thinking and coverage are very much a part of our process. So we're trying to kind of make fun of all of that as well as convey some information about what's going on that week.
There's a blurb on the back of your book jacket from Bill Clinton. It says, "Alter bites me in the ass sometimes, but at least he knows what we're trying to do." Now, I hope he wasn't being literal there.
That was from a book by Howard Kurtz that came out several years ago, that quote. But I actually like the Stephen Colbert line better.
Well, I was going to ask you about Bill Clinton. I was going to ask you about Colbert, so that's why.
But we can – yeah, Bill Clinton – I felt when I saw that Bill Clinton had said that about me and, you know, I felt that that's pretty much where I want to be with Bill Clinton. And I think he would say something a little more harsh now after this year's campaign when I wrote some quite critical things about Bill and Hillary Clinton. But throughout the years of his presidency, when I interviewed him many times, and I did the first interview with him after he left office, I felt that was kind of the right relationship to have with him, where I understood what he was trying to do and was supportive of him sometimes, but also would, as he said, bite him in the ass once in a while.
Well, the problem with something like the Monica Lewinsky scandal was that many people felt it was irrelevant to whether he was a good president or not. But people,
I didn't feel that way. I mean, I was strongly against impeachment and wrote many columns trashing Ken Starr, but I did not believe that the scandal was irrelevant in any way.
You spent an afternoon with Monica Lewinsky.
I did. I wrote about that a little bit. Yeah, in New York, right after the 2000 election, at a Thanksgiving Day parade viewing party in the home of a guy named Dick Stolle, who was the founder of People magazine, great guy. And of all people, Floyd Abrams and I were standing around talking to Monica Lewinsky, and we were talking about the most memorable part of the conversation for me was we were talking about Joe Lieberman, who's been in the news. And at that time, the outcome of the 2000 election hadn't been determined. And Monica Lewinsky said, "Well, why did Joe Lieberman run for the Senate at the same time he was running for vice president?" And I said, "For exactly this reason, because he wants to stay in the Senate should he lose for vice president. Why should he have taken the risk that he would lose and be out of a job?" And she said, "I thought politics was all about taking risks." And then she very coyly said, "I guess I'm not supposed to say that, am I?" Then when I got back to see my children, my at that time very young children, and my wife said, "He's been with Monica Lewinsky," and my young daughter burst into tears.
Well, a lot of listeners were very upset with me when I interviewed Jennifer Flowers on this show because people felt very protective of Bill Clinton. I'm not sure that that's the case anymore. There are some people do feel that the closeness of Washington society makes it difficult for journalists to maintain real objectivity.
Well, I don't believe that there is any such thing as objectivity to start with. I think you can be fair and you can be balanced if you're a straight news reporter. As a columnist, I'm actually paid to have opinions and to not be so-called objective. I think the main obligation of journalists of any kind to their readers is to get as close as they can to the truth. And that so-called standards, there's a kind of a phony balance that sometimes applies, a phony objectivity, which I don't have a lot of use for.
You've also included columns that had nothing to do with politics. You've written about The Sopranos, and there are some pieces that could be classified as personal essays, like dealing with your history as a cancer survivor. When were you diagnosed?
I was diagnosed in March of 2004, on Super Tuesday 2004, as a matter of fact, and I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a kind of a nasty variant of it called mantle cell lymphoma. And in late 2004, just after the Republican convention, I had a bone marrow transplant at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and I've been cancer-free for 4+ years since and feeling great.
Many columnists do try to maintain their personal privacy. Why did you feel like it was important to come out?
You know, I hadn't written anything for, at that time, 3 years after diagnosis. I hadn't written anything in Newsweek about it. And then in the same week, Tony Snow, who was the White House spokesman, had a recurrence, and Elizabeth Edwards had a recurrence. And I went down to North Carolina, and I interviewed Elizabeth Edwards, and she was so candid about what was going on with her and how it was affecting her, that when editors at Newsweek asked me if I wanted to weigh in, I felt like it was time, and I hoped that it could help people. And we got so much mail on that story that I like to think that I did at least a little bit.
My guest is Jonathan Alter. His latest book, Between the Lines, A View Inside American Politics, People, and Culture, published by State Street Press, which is an imprint of Borders Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Your mention of Elizabeth Edwards reminds us that John Edwards has pretty much destroyed his political life because of an indiscretion. And one of the columns in the book is about Jim McGreevy's sex scandal.
Yeah.
We've had a number of other embarrassing ones like the John Edwards. And you ask why are the most ambitious so often the most self-destructive? Elliot Spitzer, for example,
yes,
comes to mind.
And Elliot is somebody who I knew for many years before he was governor, and like his other friends, totally shocked by what happened. No clues of any kind.
Now, why do you think that is? And do we hold politicians to a different standard today? Nobody seemed to want to know about FDR's personal life or Eisenhower or JFK's. Only Nixon and Jimmy Carter have escaped the kind of conjecture in recent years, and Jimmy Carter was criticized for admitting to having lust in his heart.
Well, I think when it's president, it's different. And actually, there were people around Kennedy who thought he was acting recklessly. In the case of Roosevelt, his indiscretions, as far as we know, predated his presidency. But you're right that people didn't dig them up. They have in the more distant past. You remember Ma Ma, Where's My Pa, gone to the White House, ha ha ha, when it was revealed that Grover Cleveland had allegedly fathered an illegitimate child. It's not clear that he did.
And Warren Harding also came under attack.
Warren Harding, it came out that he had had a child out of wedlock, and his mistress wrote a book about it after his death. And then, of course, in the election of 1800, there were charges later proven true that by historians that Thomas Jefferson was having an affair with a slave. So, and that came out in 1800 during the campaign. So this idea that coverage of sex is new is not right. I draw a distinction. I've written about this a lot. There are quite a number of essays about sex and politics in this book, but I think there are kind of two ways to distinguish whether it's relevant. One is if it's president, if you're talking about the president. And my old boss and mentor, Charles Peters, the editor of the Washington Monthly, once wrote, you know, I do not want to have to wonder from whose bed the commander-in-chief will be summoned at the moment of nuclear decision. And these things do tell us something about the person in office. And by the way, it's also extraordinarily self-destructive, as we learned from Bill Clinton, to engage in that kind of reckless behavior when you're president. The other standard is if
because you should show restraint. You can wait until you're out of the White House.
Right.
But when you're there, people are holding you to a higher standard.
Yes.
You should be aware of it.
Absolutely. And you need to respect that standard, and you need to respect the White House. And so having oral sex, you know, right near the Oval Office is not cool. The other standard that would apply to Spitzer is when there are legal issues involved, or gross hypocrisy, if you've been crusading against prostitution and then engaging it yourself. So, and that's why he knew he had to resign immediately, relevant.
In the case of John Edwards, because his wife has cancer
and
we like her?
No. I strongly believe that was not relevant, and I was strongly opposed. I heard about that story long before it was in print and strongly argued that Newsweek not do anything with it, and we didn't until the story broke. Because by that time, John Edwards was no longer a candidate for president, and I simply did not see what the relevance was, and I didn't see the need to put Elizabeth through that. I think we can be human beings as well as journalists.
Well, many of your columns have been about the media, and there's one from 1992 that you call Go Ahead, Blame the Media. That's something that you could probably put on a column every month.
Yes.
Yeah. With Sarah Palin being the latest example of that, where people blame the media for giving her a hard time.
Yeah, what I learned, I covered media for about 10 years for Newsweek, and what I learned is that people like to get their political axe grinding through customs as media criticism. And usually when people are criticizing the media, what they really mean is they want the media to be more on their side. And it's not very often that you get kind of a nonpartisan media criticism, although there's so much more of it than there used to be. And it's a kind of a wonderful development in the blogosphere, I think.
But much of it is blame the messenger?
A lot of it is, but there are also people catch great mistakes that we make, and they hold us accountable in ways that in the 70s and 80s we weren't before the internet. In the 80s, Columbia named the top 10 media critics in the United States, and my name was on the list, and my mom was very proud until I told her, Mom, there are only 10 media critics in the United States. It doesn't mean very much. Today there are 10,000, and it's a good thing, although I wish bloggers would do a little more reporting and a little less media criticism.
Well, you had to be very proud of your mother. She was the first woman ever, or first Democrat anyway, ever elected in Cook County. She was the first woman to run for governor of Illinois?
Lieutenant governor, yeah.
And she just passed away recently.
She did, just 10 days ago, yeah.
Was she your inspiration for thinking as much about politics as you do?
Well, both my parents have been very interested in politics, and the answer to that is yes. They came up kind of with Adlai Stevenson in Illinois, where I was born and raised in Chicago. And so from a very young age, I was active in politics. In fact, on election night, I had a column being in Grant Park, and I'd been there 40 years ago as a 10-year-old, and my mother had grabbed my hand and pulled me out of the park right as the disturbances at the 1968 convention were underway. And I was really struck this year by what a wonderful change there was, and that the hippies who had been on one side of the barricades and the police on the other, now they were both on the same side of the barricades. There wasn't a single arrest in Grant Park when I was there on election night.
There has been a lot of speculation over Barack Obama's cabinet choices, and I saw a political cartoon which was making fun of the choices he's made so far because they're all establishment figures in the cartoon, a change poster is in the trash can.
Yeah, I think that's it's a nice cartoon, but I think it's a kind of a not very substantive criticism. You want a balance between freshness and experience. And if you want some experience in the people you put in your government, and if it's at the cabinet level, they have to have some experience. Which administration could they have served in? Which Democratic administration? Well, Bill Clinton's, unless you want somebody really old who was in Jimmy Carter's administration. Now, you can get some other people, like they're talking about Janet Napolitano, the governor of Arizona, for head of the Department of Homeland Security. She was not in the Clinton administration. Obviously, you want some kind of a mix. But to expect that they would abandon anybody who had Clinton experience was ridiculous. The distinction
we're going to get a Clinton, it looks like, because it seems
well
Bill
might.
Clinton is clearing the way for Hillary to be Secretary of State.
And I think there's a lot to recommend that, even though, as I said, I've been pretty critical of her in her presidential campaign. But the main distinction in wondering whether they're overloaded with Clintons is not whether they have any Clinton connection, but were they with Hillary as opposed to with Obama in 2008? And if they were with Obama, like a guy like Greg Craig, who's the new White House counsel, then you can't call them Clinton people.
What ultimately do you hope readers will take away from reading the body of work that's collected in this book? And what was your feeling as you looked over this collection of your columns and realized that you've changed your mind any number of times?
Well, I think I've changed my mind on some things, but I was also struck by how little my worldview has changed. I guess what I hope people take away is that you can write what Phil Graham, who first bought Newsweek for the Washington Post Company 47 years ago, called the
Graham, not Graham.
Yeah, Graham. Okay. The first rough draft of history. That's what he called journalism. And I tried to do in this book a first rough draft of history. I witnessed so many historical events from the fall of communism to the beginning of the Iraq War. I even talk about meeting people like Martin Luther King and Richard Nixon. And
you broke the butterfly ballots.
I did break that story on election night 2000. But it's less about scoops than it is about trying to write instant history and give people a feel for what it was like to write it at the time. And then people can judge for themselves whether I was right or not. Sometimes I was really right. Like on the day Sarah Palin was selected, I knew that it wasn't going to work out and wrote that in Newsweek. Other times, as I mentioned, I've been spectacularly wrong.
Now, before you go, since you mentioned that, what do you think was going on in John McCain's mind when, after 3 hours, he decided to choose her as his vice presidential running mate?
I think that he was told that there would be a walkout at the Republican convention if you pick Joe Lieberman or even Tom Ridge, since they were pro-choice, and that even though he seems like a tough guy, he wasn't tough enough to remake the Republican Party in his own image.
Tom Pawlenty, somebody like that?
Well, that was just seen as too boring of a choice, and he wanted a little bit of excitement, and he actually bought this idea that he could get Hillary voters he could pander to them and that they would vote for Palin, but they were turned off by Palin. They saw it as condescending, and it was pretty clear from the get-go that they would.
Now, you mentioned that you love the Stephen Colbert blurb. He says that you are the guy who personally persuaded him to run for president, and he says, what I'm trying to say is Jonathan Alter is a dangerous man and must be stopped. With that in mind, the book is Between the Lines, A View Inside American Politics, People, and Culture, published by State Street Press, which is an imprint of Borders Books. There's also now back on the bestseller list, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Leonard.